The following is a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
Welcome to Cartoon Fun. It's Cartoonerific. Yeah!
Well, howdy, it's Brian Mitchell. Welcome to the Cartoonerific Podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons. I'm Brian Mitchell, and I am the Master of Ceremonies. Well, last week on the podcast, we had a special guest. Actually, he did two interviews. One interview that we divided up into two episodes, that was with Mr. Jim Fanning. And if you haven't listened to those, you should go back and listen to it. He's a wonderful author. He's written a lot of liner notes on things over the last 20, 30 years, for as long as I can remember anyway. So that interview is actually a lot of fun. So if you haven't listened to it, please go back and listen to that. This week, we're going to kind of change things up a little bit. And what I mean is we're doing things differently. So a lot of you have asked, and we're complying. So today's guest is me. You asked for it, you got it. Well, the truth of the matter is, I've had a lot of people email me or send me messages and stuff, and the messages always seem to be the same. You know, we're enjoying the show, we love your guests, but love to hear a little bit more about your background. It'd be great if you did a show just about you. And so, you know, I said, yeah, eventually we'll probably do something like that. And it'll probably be like maybe a 45-minute show. And recently, a good friend of mine listened to the show. And he's not an animation guy. He likes animation, but he's not a real, I wouldn't call him a real diehard fan. But he listened to the show because he heard I had a podcast. And so he listened to it and he said, I really like what you're doing. You know, he said it's a good show. And he listened to a couple of episodes. And then he said pretty much the same thing what a lot of people have been saying, which is you should do a show about yourself and how you got into the business. So there you go. So today, the show is about your host, Brian Mitchell, but I'm not going to be helming the show. I'm not going to be asking myself questions. So, you know, put that out of your head. I enlisted Miss Marjorie Stewart. She's been a guest on the show a couple of times before. She's a design expert. And I asked her to come on and just interview me for the show. So she said yes. And she's wonderful. She has a wonderful speaking voice. And at least if you don't like listening to me, you can listen to her. So anyway, coming up next is our special guest, Mr. Brian Mitchell, yours truly. And Marjorie Stewart will be taking the helm of the show for this and the next episode. So please stay tuned. Don't go away.
You're listening to the Cartoonerific Podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons, with your host,
Marjorie Stewart.
Hello, I am Marjorie Stewart, and tonight I am going to flip the tables here in the Cartoonerific Studio. I will be interviewing our normal host of this podcast. I'm very excited about this. I've been a guest a couple times, and every time I have fun. But now I am in charge. He is an Emmy Award-winning animator. He has worked on Tiny Toons Adventures, Animaniacs, Mighty Mouse The New Adventures, Spooktacular Adventures of Casper, Prince and the Pauper, Fern Gully, The Troll in Center Park, Pink Panther, and many, many others. So please, my lovely friends, join me in a warm welcome of Mr. Brian Mitchell.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Marjorie. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So here's what.
What?
Why are we turning the tables like this? You're such a wonderful host. Everybody loves being on this show. People love, first of all, they you have so many friends who want to be interviewed by you. Everybody is just intoxicated by this velvet voice that you have. Why are you on that side of this table tonight?
I think because a lot of people have asked, they've asked me to actually be a guest on the show because there are a lot of people who know me, but they don't know my background and they want to know a little bit more about me. So I've had people just email or people in person just comment, you know, I like the podcast, but, you know, I'd like to find out more about you, like what you've done and stuff like that. So I thought this would be a good opportunity to do that and get it out of the way so that we can move forward with some of the other podcasts that we have lined up. So
yeah, even my own brother was like, when is Brian going to be on? I was like, well, I don't know how we're going to work that out.
So. Yeah. Well, we're doing it now. So there
you go. I'm excited. I'm very
Me too. I am. You know, it's a little bit nerve-wracking being on this side of the table. So, but we'll see how it goes.
Well, that's understandable. This is your creation. This is your realm. And I'm always, you know, it's been a while since I've been in this studio together with you, Brian. I always have a nice time. So
I know. It's been good stuff. A lot of good stuff. A lot of people say good things about you too. So, you know, got to have you back for another podcast. But anyway.
More homework.
Yeah.
I'm happy to do it. I love doing it. It's fun. And so, yeah, thank you for coming on my show tonight. Okay, so just from the jump, what got you started in cartoons? Like when the homeroom teacher was like, okay, boys and girls, draw a picture with the Crayola crayons and, you know, this one wants to be a doctor and that one wants to be a fireman and this one wants to be, you know, president of the United States.
Right.
Was that how you that's how this started? You drew a cartoon picture of yourself, cartoons?
No, it's funny you said about the school thing because I remember going to school being a young lad. And teacher would ask what everybody wanted, you know, what does Johnny want to do? What does Sally want to do? Whatever. And go around the room and basically these kids would all say, I want to be a fireman. I want to be a doctor. You know, you wouldn't hear a lawyer too much, but you'd hear ballerina. You'd hear all this stuff. And then they'd come around to me and I would say, I want to be a Walt Disney animator. And it's almost like you'd hear like the scratch on the record. Yeah, exactly.
Crickets.
Yeah, and I think I left a lot of teachers dumbfounded by that because that's not a normal response to a question like that for a little kid. I was really interested. I don't know where it started. I think it was probably exposure to movies and TV. I was always into fun stuff as a kid. And it was always these shows with cartoons and they'd have puppets on them and it would be TV shows, it'd be movies. And I remember going to the movie theater, they would have, what really impressed me were these Christmas shows that they would have at movie theaters. And it would just be like a holiday feature film, normally not very good. But, you know, yeah. The kids ate it up because it was Santa Claus, right?
Of course, yeah. Frosty the Snowman.
Yeah, I remember seeing a movie called The Christmas That Almost Wasn't, which is, it was a foreign film that was actually dubbed, but it featured an actor. It was actually a host of a show called Paul Tripp. His name was Paul Tripp. And so I remember seeing that in the theater maybe around 1966. And then they would show cartoons with it. And a lot of them were Tom and Jerry cartoons. And when these things came up on the screen, they were pretty magical. And so those shows really captured my imagination and got me enthused about cartoons. But there was a lot of other things. TV ran a lot of these old Popeyes and Betty Boop cartoons and all these old Warner Brothers Bugs Bunny cartoons. Porky Pig, and then everything, all the cartoons were on TV. So it was like, you know, Walter, these Woody Woodpeckers would be shown.
Right.
Chili Willies, Roadrunner. Yeah. So all these cartoons would be shown. I remember Saturday morning, it's just one cartoon after the other, because that's every channel, CBS, NBC, ABC, had all these cartoons on, but they were all on during the week too. And so they would have these hosts on that would basically, they were live action, real people hosting these shows, and they would have the Popeye show, and they would have a Bugs Bunny show, and they would have, I'm trying to think of some of the other ones. There's so many of them. But there were these live action hosts that a lot of them were very talented, you know, local TV. So people like Soupy Sales and Chuck McCann had shows. And there was a show that I grew up on called Wonderama, which it was a 3 hour show on Sunday mornings. It ran from like 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock. And that show had guests on, and sometimes it would have some of the cartoonists on.
Oh, wow.
Or they'd have Jim Henson on.
Wow. I didn't know that cartoons had live hosts.
Yeah, back in the day, because, you know, you find this out later. I found this out later on, but it was like the cartoons were only 6 minutes long.
Uh-huh.
You know, maybe a cartoon might be 5 minutes, 6 minutes, 7 minutes long, so they'd run maybe 3.5 hours. And so they had time in between the cartoons. If the cartoons were only 5 or 6 minutes, they had to fill up the time. So they'd have a host come on and kind of flesh out the time.
Okay, so I've never known about this. So just to kind of, I like to watch Turner Classic Movies.
Yes.
And what I love is I love the movies, but I really love how they introduce each film, and they have a wonderful host who tells backstories and histories and development and
right.
So like that?
It was more fun. They might have, somebody with puppets and stuff. You know, it was little kids. A lot of those cartoons, you know, you watch them today and it's like they were showing this to little kids, you know, it's like the Three Stooges they were showing to kids.
Right.
Very violent. It was comic violence, which not very realistic. And I think kids knew that. But they weren't really aimed at kids, you know. Like the road, I know as a fact that when my father was in the Navy, because he would tell me about this, he said they would run a reel of Roadrunner cartoons for the men in the Navy. And they would laugh. They were funny cartoons. And they weren't really aimed at kids. But the certain cartoons were definitely aimed more for the small fry, but a lot of the Looney Tunes were made for the people who are making them.
Interesting.
So they would show them in the theater, the studio theater, and they would laugh. You know, they would laugh as much as anybody else would. Yeah, and they were enjoying it too. So they were. That's a thing that I learned about a lot of these cartoons, like the Tom and Jerry's, you know, they're trying to make them funnier every time. You know, every time they put a new one out, they're trying to make it better than the last one.
Right.
So they're trying to come up with crazier gags and stuff like that. And,
yeah.
And you know, and if you're making the adults laugh, you're probably going to make the kids laugh too. So, so that's, that was kind of their thing. And that's something I learned years later.
I didn't get kind of hip to, as you know, I didn't really grow up with cartoons, and we've discussed that. But I didn't really get hip to the fact that animated movies and things can appeal to adults until my family started having little children in it, and they would be like, let's watch Boss Baby, let's watch Cars, let's watch, you know. And I'm right there with them laughing. We're all laughing along together.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a stigma that is because, you know, back in the 50s and 60s when studios were, not the studios, not the movie studios, but television needed a lot of material. And the studios at the time were competing with TV and they didn't want to release any of their motion pictures. I mean, even Disney didn't want to release any of their motion pictures to television. But the short subjects were okay. So all these short subjects ended up on TV. So a lot of travelogues and the cartoons did very, very well on TV. They got very good ratings whenever they ran them. So it was a win-win for the studios and it was a win-win for TV. And so that's why all the stuff was just dumped onto television. I mean, they made a pretty penny, but they could have made a lot more. Back in the day, the Warner Brothers cartoons and a lot of the early Popeyes, they were just sold into television. And Warner Brothers, not too long ago, realized, I guess they somehow were able to reacquire the cartoons that they sold years ago to TV so that now they own everything.
You are not the first guest on this show, your show. Now it's my show.
It's your show.
That who has said, and I have to say, I've been very impressed how many of your guests say, I've always known I wanted to be an animator. I knew when I was 5, 6 years old. That right. generally seems to be the consensus. When I was 5 and 6 years old, I have no idea what I wanted to be when I sort of grew up.
Right.
So right. that always has really, really, really impressed upon me, and that it really is very much up there, I guess, a calling.
I think it is. I think there, you know, I have a lot of thoughts about this. I'm actually writing a book about this, about my personal experiences. But I think that everybody has, you know, basically something they're supposed to do. And I think that there are some kids that know they want to be a doctor. I mean, they absolutely know they want to be a doctor. They've already kind of figured that out.
Yeah.
The weird thing about people that want to be animators, they want to work in this profession from a very young age. It's not everybody. Some people find it later. And we've had a few guests on the podcast that have said that. But I find the people that wanted to work at Disney knew very young. And I would say I was one of those. I never did work for Disney in-house. I always kind of freelanced for them on different projects later on. Well, I guess we'll get to that. But I pretty much knew this is what I wanted to do. And I was always a creative kid. So I was always like, you know, it was either going to be puppets or it's going to be a host. You know, I was going to be like a show host.
Well, you are.
Well, now I am, yeah. But, well, not today.
Not today. Not my time.
Yeah, but yes, it's your show. Just want to say that.
So puppets because of, I mean, I'm just assuming, was that because of Jim Henson's work?
I had always liked puppets. There was a gentleman who had a puppet studio in New York named Bill Baird, who was very famous. And so I'll give you a little bit of background. So I was always into that. I was into, you know, it. When I saw The Jungle Book, I think it was maybe 5 or 6 when it first came out in 1967. Came out the year after Walt Disney passed away.
Okay, was that your first Disney movie that you saw in a theater?
No.
Okay.
No. But no, because I'd seen many. I'd seen Snow White and I can't tell you how many I've seen before that, but I mean, I used to watch the Disney TV show religiously, but I used to watch Looney Tunes on Saturday mornings and during the week. So, but Jungle Book, when I saw Jungle Book in the theater, it was in Brooklyn and it was during the day. My father took me to see it and I sat there watching the movie and I just remember looking at the scene with Baloo the bear and the boy, and knowing that it was drawn. And I remember saying this to myself in the seat, I know they're drawings, but they look so real. They look, and what I really meant to say was they look so believable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not real, but I guess at 6 or 7 years old, that's the way I
articulate.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. And it was a pivotal moment in my life, because I made that realization. You know, I used to watch cartoons all the time, and I never really kind of clicked.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Until then.
Cathartic moment.
Yeah, and it was so it made a big impression on me.
When children are creative and sensitive and have a wonderful imagination, there are moments when you are experiencing something that is a false reality, but it strikes you or moves one in such a way that it's almost like you're having an out-of-body experience, because your brain is saying, no, it's fabricated, it's made up. The way it's making you feel on the inside is so true to what you know is real.
Right, right.
So I can see why that left such a lasting impression on you. That would have, that stayed
all this time.
For all this time.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy, and it often strikes me funny how these moments kind of just hit me and just stay. Forever, you know, it's embedded in my brain. So it's it's something, real something.
So you and your father went together, just the two of you.
Yeah, it was some theater in Brooklyn. I don't remember the name of the theater.
Is that where you grew up?
In Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was born in Brooklyn in 1961 in December. And so maybe that's why I have such fond memories of the Christmas holiday there.
Did he take just you to that because he already knew of your interest in cartoons and your propensity for creativity? And
I don't know. I don't know why. We used to, I think he liked the Disney films. And I'm not just talking about animated. I think he liked some of the live-action films, too. And I think it was he knew they were relatively safe to take his son or daughter to. And so we would see a lot of different Disney films. But with this one, I probably saw the preview on the TV show and may have said to him that I wanted to see it. And so he took me. I remember after that we went to... he had to fill up the car with gas. So he stopped off at a Gulf gas station. And Gulf had the Disney magazine that was kind of like a giveaway. You know, you get, you know, you fill up your tank and they give you the magazine.
Yeah.
And so, and it had the making of the Jungle Book and had like a little article and stuff about it. And, but they also had another thing, which I don't know if it was a giveaway or he paid a dollar. But it was also a record album, and it was these songs from Disney songs from, well, not the soundtrack, but a couple of songs from it, you know, like The Bare Necessities and I Want to Be Like You. But it also had other Disney songs on it. And you know, of course, as soon as we got home, I probably popped that on the record player.
Oh, what a happy memory.
Yeah. So, and, yeah, the album, I forgot the name of it. I know what it looks like, but it's that's another thing that kind of goes with that. So, yeah, it was a wonderful afternoon to see the movie and then get the soundtrack and stuff like that.
That's very special.
Yeah, I am a Disney fan going way back, but I'm a fan of a lot of things that are...
Is Brooklyn where you grew up, or is that where you were born? Did you grow up? In Brooklyn.
Grew up in Brooklyn, well, for a couple of years. We moved away, I believe, in 68, 69, and then we moved further out the island, not too far from Manhattan, maybe about a half hour away. But moving away from, you know, New York City and moving what I thought was a country, we moved in. There are no sidewalks where we moved, you know. And so... That was interesting, because it was almost like a culture change, because it's so much different from going to school in the city and then now you're in the suburbs and
yeah,
it's kind of different. But it didn't really
I want to say it didn't really affect me in a bad way. I like moving out.
Yeah.
I kind of missed where we were, but I quickly adapted to where we were, you know, where we moved to. And, you know, we still, it wasn't like anything really changed. You know, you had movie theaters around. It just wasn't Manhattan. It wasn't mm-hmm. Brooklyn, you know.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the older cartoons came from the New York
Yeah, I mean, the industry started in New York City mainly because all the comic strips were done in this area. You know, you had the comic strip artists had to be close to the publishers, so, and the syndicates that distributed it. So a lot of them were in Manhattan. So you had like King Features and United Media. A lot of these were in the city, and basically what they would do is they would do the comic strips and they run it in to Manhattan. Now, maybe years later that changed, but because you had so many cartoonists here working in the business, that's where the studio started in like the 1900s, 1910s, 1920s.
Yeah.
And so you had a gentleman by the name of Max Fleischer. Max and Dave Fleischer set up their studio in Manhattan. And it started off small, and then it grew. And they were using these comic strip artists. And there was another studio called Terry Toons, another one called Bray Studios. Had a bunch of them in the New York area. So the industry really started here. But what happened was, you had an upstart by the name of Walt Disney.
I figured.
Who was in Kansas City trying to do animated cartoons. And he was training people. He was producing these cartoons in the Midwest and basically trained a bunch of people and took them all to California.
He stole them.
No, they just went with him. No, what happened was people stole his artists from him or hired them away. And so when Disney set up in California, he was basically trying to make the cartoons better. And he had people in his employ, two guys named Rudolph Ising and Hugh Harmon, and also another guy by the name of Frizz Freeling, and Ub Iwerks. And all these people were working, and Ub Iwerks was very important to the studio. But what ended up happening was the person who was distributing Walt's cartoons at the time, I guess in 1928, had a cartoon character called Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. And the distributor, who was in New York, basically told him, well, you know, if you don't make the cartoons cheaper, I'm going to hire your staff away and basically we'll produce them. Mm-hmm. And was going to just take the character away from him. Mm-hmm. And so these people ended up, some of them stayed with Disney. Ub Iwerks stayed with Disney, but eventually he left and he started his own studio. Frizz Freeling, I think, went to work for Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers was trying to start up a studio. I think that was with, and Harmon and Ising, Harmon Ising, that was a studio name. They basically set up under Warner Brothers and then eventually went to MGM. So they were setting up the cartoon departments, and Oswald the Lucky Rabbit ended up over at Universal Studios, and Woody Woodpecker came out of that. So basically Disney kind of trained everybody in the business, but they kind of all went into different directions.
I see.
And so he, you know, he's the guy most responsible for getting, you know, and a lot of people don't give him enough credit, but he basically trained everybody in the business. Yeah. So
that is amazing.
Yeah. And those other people trained other people as well. So yeah.
It strikes me as, and just one last point, mm-hmm. it strikes me as animation is one of those sort of last frontier of where there is that mentorship and where I think that was from what I've learned from you, very fostered by a model that Walt Disney kind of set up.
Yeah.
That mentorship, that sort of master Padawan
yeah,
thing.
No.
But let me just say, mm-hmm. we know that you are an highly impressive encyclopedia of animation history, right. But we are here to discuss your history.
That's right.
So
that's
right. I'm going to have to bring us back to your growing
You're roping me back.
Wrangling you.
There you go.
Back to you and growing up and the schools that you went to growing up or where you grew up. Did that foster your creativity? Did you end up at a school in your formative years that really encouraged art and encouraged creativity?
Yeah. I guess, you know, when we moved out to the island, I always kind of jumped at like any opportunity, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't go to like any special school. I went to public schools but one of the first schools I went to out here is a school called Marion Delaney School, which was a 1 through 6 maybe, or 3 to 6. And so anyway, they were doing a little newspaper that they wanted to come up with a name. So they asked all the kids in the school to come up with a name for the newspaper. And me, at the time, being into puppets, I said, why don't you just call it the Marionette? And because Marion Delaney. So I submitted that and won that, and they named the paper the Marionette. And that was, maybe I was in, I'm thinking I was in sixth grade when that happened. But I used to do like little comic strips for the newspaper too.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. So I did that in sixth grade, and what was interesting about that was I also did that year. I don't know if it was that year or the year before, but there was a competition because I was very into puppets still, and so my father found out that they were doing something in Nassau County, Long Island, where it was a puppet competition. Like, you have to create the puppets, and then you perform the puppets on a stage over at Eisenhower Park, which is in the center of Nassau County, Long Island. And so he just found out about it. We found out about it, that it was going to happen probably in about, I think it was within 2 weeks. I don't even think we had that much time. But I found out about it, and then we called and found out, yeah, you know, you could still get in if you want, but – you know, you have to have your own show. You got to create your own show. And I had, before that, maybe the year before, I had taken classes in New York City at the Museum of New York City, right? I think I told you about
the Museum of the City of New York.
City of New York, yeah.
Fifth Avenue.
So I had taken classes with a professional puppeteer named Rod Young. Mm-hmm. And Rod Young had done a bunch of commercials in New York that, you know, was used marionettes and stuff like that. But he was a respected puppeteer. And so he was one of the judges for this thing, I found out. But anyway, we called up and I had to come up with a show. I had to come up with something. And I had to put something together on the fly, and I ended up recording it on reel-to-reel tape. And we went down there, and I had to perform the show to actually get into the competition.
Oh, like an audition.
Yeah, but I had, like, not even a week to put this thing together.
Uh-huh.
And so we did that, went down there, and they liked what I did. And so they let me go and do the competition. So the following week, it was on a Saturday. I remember going down, and there were a lot of other people there doing things, you know, on stage. And so my turn came up, and I did my show. And I just remember bits and pieces of it. It's just really crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But I ended up winning 3 third-place prizes, I was really surprised. But what was really neat was my father was pretty impressed by it, because he was like, all these professionals were coming up to him and they were saying, you know, your son has something.
Mm-hmm.
Your son is talented. Mm-hmm. And So that, you know, I think in his head, he thought, oh, you know, this kid's going to go on. He's going to be like, you know, Bill Baird or Jim Henson or whatever. He's going to, you know, take the world by storm as a puppeteer. But I think I had seen another Disney film. I think it was the reissue of The Jungle Book, maybe the year later.
Oh, really?
And I was like,
it circled you.
It circled me back. It roped me back in.
Drawn animation.
Yeah. So he wasn't happy when I told him that this is what I wanted to do.
But I mean, it's still animation.
It's still, you know, I talked. There was a gentleman that designed all the Muppets for Henson. His name is Michael Frith. I don't know if he's still around, but Michael Frith was a key designer for Henson. And years later, I called him up and we were talking. He said, well, you know, it's all interconnected. You bring something to life that's inanimate.
Yeah.
And so, which I knew, but, you know, but he was acknowledging that, you know, because I said to him, you know, I would love to work for Henson. It would be me coming back around. This is maybe 20 years ago.
Right.
And it was after Jim Henson had passed away. And he said, well, yeah, but if that happened, you'd be taking my job. So it was.
That's funny.
It was funny, yeah. But no, he's a very nice gentleman. So there you go.
So, I mean, talking about like your early influencers would be obviously Walt Disney, right. Jim Henson,
Chuck Jones, who did a lot of these wonderful Roadrunner cartoons, creator of the Roadrunner, Pepe Le Pew, a lot of wonderful Bugs Bunny cartoons. I love Fritz Frelinghuysen. Bob Clampett is another one. What's interesting is the things that I liked as a kid, I ended up working later on like remakes of these shows.
Well, the Casper.
Casper and a show that I really liked as a kid was Beanie and Cecil, which was a cartoon show. And there was a revival years later that I ended up working on. And so I was one of the, I was laying out the scenes for the animators. So drawing the characters and the character posing and backgrounds and stuff like that. But I ended up working on that show. And of course, with Mickey, Donald, and Goofy, I ended up years later animating Mickey Mouse for Disney. But that, I think we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Right. Yeah. So those influencers who are, you know, the all-time, you know, in the pantheon of anime.
Right.
But what about closer to home? Were there any teachers or instructors at your school who really left any kind of stamp?
It's funny. Maybe more musical. Because I was in band and orchestra.
Yeah.
And I would say those people, yes. But it's sad to say, as I was growing up, and I had an art teacher in high school that, you know, she was at, you know, because I was in art classes there. And I didn't find them very good because you were drawing, but you're drawing, you know, like
drawing
a vase.
A fruit. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
An apple.
Right. And so when I said that I wanted to be an animator, it's like her first thing was like, oh, that's not art.
Oh, but drawing a fruit, apple, banana, and cherries is art.
Yeah. It's a total misunderstanding of the – because it absolutely is. You're controlling – it's just on film, you know. You're basically – controlling the color and the light, and when you're drawing the characters, you're drawing them with personality,
the motion.
Through the motion, and it's if anything, it's the most original art form.
It most certainly is. I mean, it's
recently, like the last 100 years, you know, basically, it's you know, you've had painting, you've had drawing, you know, forever, but now you have this whole new thing where what could be more artistic than expressing a character's emotions, you know, through a series of drawings?
Of
you know,
course.
You have to be, The one misconception that a lot of people make, especially people that don't are not animators or have no understanding of it, is the fact of how much artistic training these people go through. Because in order to animate something, you've got to be able to draw really, really well. And so it requires a lot of training, anatomy and art studies, color studies, background studies, and then a lot of drawing. Just know to get to a certain level where I could actually draw a character from all angles was a tremendous amount of work. So, you know, some people discount it, and I've had that was one teacher that just really, and I won't say her name, but it's just, you know, the thing is that I wasn't discouraged by it. I just thought to myself, wow, you really don't know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. You know, I feel bad for maybe some other students that might not be as clear-minded or, you know, had a clear vision of what they wanted to do. Because somebody like that could really,
really discourage
somebody from doing something that they really want to do.
You've okay. had a few moments where, more than a few, where one might have gotten discouraged.
Right.
You know, when you were five and announced your Disney intentions.
Yeah, no, I think discouragement is something that just happens when you're going after a career in the arts.
Yeah.
And it's just the very nature is like there's so many people around you that are good at what they do, whether it's dancers and artists and actors and musicians, all these people that, you know, you get the cream of the crop of the school.
Yeah.
And so, but you have to go past those people.
Right. And there are some people who are not just good at one of those many things, or multiple.
They're just natural
talents. Yeah.
Natural talents. But that's just a thing.
Yeah. So what moments in your life did you have that were encouraging up until this point? I mean, where did you go on after high school? Did you end up at a place that was, you know,
well,
fostering your ability?
This is, we were talking about the puppetry thing and how I kind of abandoned that at 13. And, right. And
well, in some people's eyes, maybe you abandoned it, but it took on another form.
I think it took on another form, but I don't think my father saw it that way.
Sure. Yeah, I can see
and,
that.
Yeah, and I think he thought that I was reaching for something that I shouldn't be reaching for. Because I don't think, you know, I drew, I was drawing, but I was not excellent by any stretch of the imagination.
Wow, really?
I had an affinity for drawing, and I'd been drawing since I was 4 years old, but I had not refined it to a point where it was, you know, I would say like really good.
Yeah.
But I think he kind of looked at, you know, the puppetry thing and he saw, well, you know, he was really good at that. So, yeah. But now he's thrown that away. And it's like now he wants to go into animation. And
will he cast that by the wayside as well, I guess?
Exactly.
Would be a parent's fear.
So I wanted to go to a school that taught art and character animation. There's only a handful in the United States. It's Pratt, which is in Brooklyn, New York, mm-hmm. One of the schools. And then you had Cal Arts, which is California Institute of the Arts, which is basically a merging of two schools that actually Walt Disney kind of put right. those two schools together.
Yes.
Or helped with it and helped fund it. And there are people at that school that just deny that ever happened. But that's the truth. And a lot of people don't know it.
Wow.
But, you know, I think when Mary Poppins came out, he did some sort of a screening to benefit Cal Arts because this was in 1964 and he was trying to raise money and get that school set up. Right. So that was a school I wanted to go to. And there weren't a whole lot others. I mean, there was School of Visual Arts in New York, which had animation programs in it, but it also had the art programs and they had a film program. School of Visual Arts was the closest thing to me. And Pratt was not in the best area at the time. It's still in the same place, but it's the area's gotten a lot better.
It's an excellent school.
It's an excellent school, yeah. So anyway, I had my sights set on School of Visual Arts. I felt that that was close and get there by train shouldn't be a problem, you know, a 30-minute train ride into Manhattan from Long Island. You know, I talked to my parents about it. My father thought, he said, you know, you should really go to a community college and make sure this is what you want to do. We had Nassau Community College, which was an okay school, you know. And it's basically, you know, a lot of people joke and they say it's, 13th grade in high school. You know?
Not nice.
They had an art program over there. And so I applied, I got in. And what was interesting was first day taking a class with an instructor there. He went around the room and he asked everybody what they wanted to do. In the art field.
Oh, here we go again.
And so he went around and basically, you know, once again, I stuck out like a sore thumb because I was a kid who wanted to be the Disney animator.
Right.
And he laid into me.
Really?
And it was very uncomfortable because it was like a 15, 20 minute tirade.
Oh, my word.
And I think.
Golly.
I think what happened there was
my cheeks would have been burning red.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we talk about discouragement with the high school art teacher.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. This guy was just, you know, oh, you can't do that. And it's like, you know, how many people they accept? You know, it's really tough to get into Disney. And so he must have had some experience.
Whoa.
And so a lot of people have been rejected from Disney over the years. You know, Charles M. Schulz was rejected from Disney, the creator of Peanuts, Charlie Brown and Snoopy.
Mm-hmm.
And look what happened to him. You know, persevered, right?
Different.
Totally different.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they turned him down. But anyway, so I understood where he was coming from, but for me, I wasn't going to be like an illustrator for.
It wasn't the school to foster and to cultivate your designs on being an animator.
Absolutely.
It was not the place. But you know, in another sense, you were lucky that your father was not one of the many discouragers. He just was saying, let's just make sure.
Let's make sure.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
But I was getting very down, not because of what the instructor said to me. I was just getting very down because I felt like the school was not providing me with what I wanted.
The education.
I felt like it was almost delaying getting into that
access
career.
To the tools that you need to,
exactly.
to break into.
My sister said something that was very interesting. And, you know, she said, you know, it's not the school.
Right.
It's you. It's what you want to achieve. And the thing is, you know, you seek out the knowledge. You seek out the knowledge to do something. But a lot of schools are just average. It's like you have to kind of go in there and just, you know, have a laser beam on what you want to do and pursue that and the information. And that's what I ended up doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I ended up calling a lot of people in the business to find out what do I need to do, what classes do I need to take, and stuff like that.
Yes, but I mean, then you know, honestly, I think that applies to so many schools. You could be going to such a top notch school, and it's the education that they could potentially lavish on you is just washing over you, and you're doing what you can to get the degree.
That is true.
In any field.
That is true. But I'm also a firm believer that if you want to do something, you should really surround yourself with like-minded people that want to do it.
Certainly.
And I just felt like that wasn't happening.
So how long did you stay at Nassau Community?
Not very long.
After the 20-minute tirade.
Not very long. I think I was there for maybe a month and a half, and I just...
Yeah.
I was just like, this is a waste. This is really a waste. And so I dropped out. And so I told my dad, I said, look, I know what I want to do. This is what I want to do. And I need to go to a school that is going to teach me film, and it's going to teach me the art, figure drawing, anatomy, color. I need all that. And the closest thing here is School of Visual Arts in the city. And that's so anyway, I applied for it and I got in, and they turned out some very good talent.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't give you any pushback.
I don't think so. I think he saw that I was serious about it.
Yeah.
And
is this why he was your date to the Emmys?
Yeah, that's we'll talk about that later, but yeah. Yeah, that's what happened.
I'm the interviewer.
You are the interviewer. So anyway, yeah, so I got into School of Visual Arts, and that was a good thing, because immediately I was taking animation classes, and in the time, the lead up to those classes, I took like a winter class on a Saturday, which was life drawing. So I started getting into School of Visual Arts by taking some of those drawing classes.
And life drawing is where this like little old lady comes in for $50 and takes off all her clothes. And
it could be anybody taking off their clothes. And sometimes I was surprised to see, you know, you'd get, you know, an older gentleman come in and remove all his clothes and sit there. And sometimes it was horrifying. But but the key is to draw.
It's important.
It's really, yeah. And you have to draw everything. Mm-hmm. So you would get, you know, it was basically nude male and female models. And, you know, the first time doing that, it was the first time I ever drew from a nude model. And so it was for about 5 minutes. It is, I don't want to say 5 minutes, 3 minutes. It's a shock when you first do that.
Yeah.
Because never been in a situation like that where you're in a room full of people and, you know, there's a stand in the middle, you know, some platform, and then they go up and all of a sudden they take off a robe and it's like, kaboom, there they are, you know?
Yeah, no, I know. I was actually introduced to that in high school art.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, and we were told very strict, you have to be very professional.
Yes.
Very, very professional, very professional about how you look at them. And, mm-hmm. and you know, for a 15, 16-year-old kid, it's like, okay, I'm going to do my best. I'll do my best.
Yeah. But you eventually, you warm up.
Yeah.
And then it just becomes, then you're just doing a drawing from that. And you learn a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. The bones. Where are the bones? The veins under the skin. How the muscles move. I mean, you're not going to get that from that other teacher in high school with the fruit.
Exactly.
No.
No. So that's what happened. But it was. But I started to really enjoy it and get into, because I had been doing these little cartoons. You know, I never did anything that was based off of life. It was always cartoony kind of character. And I had to kind of switch my thinking. And I started doing it, and I started liking drawing life, you know, life drawing. You know, it was almost like a switch. You know, first it was like, oh, what am I doing? And, you know, but then finally you click in. And then I actually enjoy going to those classes. I get a cup of coffee, bring a cup of coffee with me, sit there, you know, waiting for this class to start. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing, you know, was kind of neat. So, yeah. Finally got into the classes.
School of Visual Arts.
And School of Visual, and on the curriculum, right? They put me in film classes.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And the film classes are very important.
Is this because they didn't have a department for animation? You had to make some sort of an amalgam.
Yeah, you're putting together
your own curriculum.
Yeah, you're putting it together yourself.
Got it. Okay.
And it's that's really a problem, because some people don't know. I mean, I kind of knew what I needed. Screenwriting, I was taking film classes. And I think I had one animation class and no drawing classes the first year. Man, you know, this is not good. I really need, you know, you have to be able to draw to animate. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to draw well, mm-hmm. like really well. They weren't providing that. And so, you know, I actually went to the department head, mm-hmm. and I said, you know, this is not really working. I don't know why I'm taking all these film classes, like 8 film classes and 1 animation class.
Sure.
I said, I need the drawing.
Yeah.
I need intense drawing, life drawing and anatomy and all that stuff. You know, they said to me, or the person there said to me, you can get that the 3rd and 4th year.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And it's like, no.
Yeah.
People who go to Cal Arts,
sure.
they're drilling in the drawing classes yes. from day one.
Yeah.
And they're teaching them how to animate and how to put a film together with the drawing classes. And a lot of those people graduate, they leave in 2 years.
Right. It's all much more holistic approach to creating yeah. that.
It's more directed. Art. Well, the program yeah. was set up by the Disney studio.
Of course.
I knew what that was. And, you know, and so I just felt like it was it Bass Ackwards? Right. mm-hmm. right. That was something that really bothered me. Around that, I have to say this because around that time, there were a group of animators that left Disney, and it was Don Bluth.
Uh-huh.
And his crew.
They left Disney,
and they impressed me because they did a film. They did a film that was on HBO, and then they brought it to ABC. I think it was called Banjo the Woodpile Cat. The first film they ever did. Outside of Disney. Mm-hmm. Actually, they were working on it at nights and weekends, whatever. But they put this thing on HBO, and I believe I saw it on HBO, and it looked like a Disney film.
Wow.
And so they had – it made big news because they had left Disney maybe a couple of weeks before I saw it or something like that.
Oh.
And so when I saw the film, I was like, wow, you know, you guys are doing Disney. And they were doing all the effects and stuff, the dewdrops and rain and reflections in this film and stuff like that. And it was a cute film. It's a good story. It's not Gone with the Wind, you know. It's just a nice little film. But yeah, no. But it was a good film, expertly animated by these ex-Disney people.
Right. And what was their motivation to splinter off from Disney?
What happened was they were dissatisfied with what was happening at Disney, which was they were cheapening out on the films and they weren't putting too much care in the stories and stuff like that. And this group wanted to make animation better. I mean, they would say that.
So can you just, 1979, just filmography-wise, where are we at? Where the Don
Bluth.
Bluth sect wanting to break away.
Okay. They were, all these people had been trained in the 70s at Disney and were working on films like Robin Hood and Winnie the Pooh. Oh, The Rescuers.
Yeah.
A lot of them cut their teeth on that picture. And so they were working there, but they were getting very discouraged over at Disney because Disney was not giving them the budgets. They wouldn't allow them to do certain things like dew drops on leaves. And, you know, they weren't putting a lot of care into.
That's fascinating
yeah.
because that's so.
Yeah.
To cut.
Well, because all those little things require money.
Realism.
Yeah. All those things require money. And so they figured, well, we could just animate the film, you know, we'll create a good story, be, you know, some fun, make it funny, and then put the thing out. But they felt like the Disney studio was really cutting back on all these effects, just simple things like shadows.
Yeah.
There was a waterfall. They wouldn't animate the waterfall. You know, I mean, stupid things.
Got it.
Yeah. But it was all budgetary. And so
Don Bluth was like, just for our listeners, it's like Secret of Nim.
Secret of Nim was the film, their first feature film after leaving Disney.
Because you see a lot of carryover from the Rescuers.
To that.
That stuff, yes.
Yeah, I don't think that was, I think that was just a decision. I think they needed a book. I think it was just an accident. The characters don't look like the character. They don't look like the mice and the Rescuers.
They're, no, but like style, style-wise, I think.
Yeah, I think, I agree with that. But they were able to get all these wonderful little effects, you know, cobwebs and, you know, all. You know, if you look at the film, a lot of effects, a lot of lavish effects. The characters are really well drawn. A lot of care taken to the cleanup of the drawings. The colors are really nicely orchestrated. Oh, no, muted colors, you know, which I know you like.
I do. But I also like the artwork from Secret of Nim.
Yeah.
I have a great appreciation.
Yeah. No, it's they lavished a lot of love on that. But that was basically when they left Disney. Before they left Disney, they were working on a film called Banjo the Woodpile Cat, where they were relearning how to put all this stuff back into a film, because they weren't learning it from Disney, so they had to kind of seek that out. So I had seen that film that they did. Once they left Disney, it ended up on HBO and then eventually to ABC. But I saw the film on HBO, and I was like, wow. You know, it was so much better than what Disney was doing at the time. So I called them up.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah, I was able to get their number. I called them up. I found out where they were, which was in Culver City, California. And so I think the first person I talked to was this guy, Gary Goldman. And he said, nobody's called us about this. You know, you're like the first person that's called us about this film. And then it kind of passed the phone around because, you know, I was just telling him how much I loved the film. They didn't even know who the heck I was. And so anyway, somehow a friendship developed from that.
So you're just like picking up,
just picking up the phone.
Picking up the phone.
Picking up the phone, just calling. Yeah, it's
like, yo, what's up?
Yo, what's up? Somebody I don't know, you know, I just know you from.
Could you imagine in today's day, was this on a rotary dial?
It was on a rotary dial. So, we had a podcast Jim Fanning, which just we put up and
yes,
He's contacting the head of Disney, this guy, Ron Miller. And it's like, why don't you come into the office? We'll chat, you know?
Come on in.
And come on in, yeah.
Scotch?
Here's my wife.
This is just, this does not work like this
today. Yeah, there are weird things that happen in life.
I also just think, you don't let anybody discourage you, you know?
Yeah. I mean, at the time I was just like, I guess when I called them and I told them, wow, you guys are, you know, I know you were at Disney and you're doing such wonderful work and stuff like that. And I think when you're sincere, you can endear yourself to somebody over the phone. Mm-hmm. And so, a friendship developed long distance.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they were looking at my drawings eventually, you know, and they were like, you know, they had an animator there who's considered one of the best in the business. There's many great animators, but at the time he was phenomenal. His name was John Pomeroy, and he was looking at my drawings and making corrections on my drawings and saying, you need to do this more and this, but he said, you know, but your drawings remind me of this guy that worked at Disney back in the 40s, which was a gentleman named Fred Moore. And this is a guy who pretty much designed Mickey Mouse the way Mickey Mouse looks today. And he said, your drawings remind me of that. So I would get all these wonderful comments. And then eventually they flew me out to California because I was while I was doing this, I said, is there any way I can help you in New York get you more publicity here? I said, because, you know, maybe I can help that way. And they said, yeah, you know, it'd be nice you can get us into the Museum of Modern Art and stuff like that. Or, and I don't know if that was...
this is in the days before there was such a thing as PR.
Yeah. No, there was PR back there.
Oh.
Yeah. Because they had a PR person that worked for them. But I ended up getting them into the Museum of Modern Art. I got them into an art gallery to present some of the artwork from the first film they did.
Yeah.
I was able to get them publicity on some TV stations in New York. And they really appreciated what I was doing. And then they ended up flying me out to California for a week and visiting the studio.
Wow.
And this is in 1981, right? So a lot of good stuff was happening. And so...
And you're still at art students studying.
Still going to school, yeah. So so what happened when I went out there, they gave me a couple of tests and they offered me a job. They said, you know, you did the two tests, they look good. You know, we can have you, you could be doing some assistant work for us.
Wow.
And so they offered me a job. And that's like, that doesn't happen every day.
Yeah.
So I was...
Wow.
It was 1981, and I think they're working on The Secret of NIMH, so I saw a lot of the stuff. They actually put me to work on a scene to help with the effects. And so none of my work is actually in the picture, but indirectly, because the animators were... I was just tracing off a lamp that they had shot in live action,
mm-hmm.
and it was kind of swaying. And so they had these stats, and so I was just tracing off the base of the lamp. Basically, the animators had to use that as a guide animate the character to.
Oh, wow.
And so I got no credit on it, but I did it, you know, and I was working with Doris Lamfer, who was a top effects guy
mm-hmm.
on that. So that was, so they let me do that. And then they offered me a job. And
so this was your first job offer.
First job offer, and I didn't take it.
Oh, no.
Because I was like...
Why, oh, why?
Why, oh, why? I was 19, about to be 20.
So young.
God. And, yeah, and I was like, you know, I was in shock that, you know, I wanted to pass the test. But then once I passed the test, I was like, yeah, but I really want to, I still want to get better, you know. And, you know, they told me, they said that, you know, when you work here, you can go to art, you know, I guess, what was the name of it? Art League or Art Center. I think it was Art Center.
Uh-huh.
In Northridge. So you could go there.
Yeah.
You know, you could take classes there. And, if you want to do that. But, you know, you're going to learn faster by doing this in the studio and working with all these top people. They were the cream of the crop of the Disney studio. Right. I mean, there were other people at Disney's that were very good too, but they were, Don Bluth was the one that they were grooming to be taking over the animation department.
Wow.
So he was basically, he had a bunch of great people. He had men and women that were really good working there. And so what I've learned faster probably, because I would have been doing it every day. I would have been working under these people and trying to rise to their level. So, but I opted, you know, I said, I want to think about it. So I said, yeah, you know, think about it and, you know, let us know what you want to do. And so I went back to New York and I was like, I just want to continue. I was happy going to School of Visual Arts and then Art Students League.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what I ended up doing. But
is
what
this because you're a perfectionist or no, but I mean like were you like, I wanna, you know for sure that my wings have fully grown to their utmost before I fly?
I think that was part of it. That's actually a good question. It's a really good question. I think part of it was I didn't want to leave because I was still very close with my mom and dad, you know, and I didn't feel like the time was, you know, I just had a strong feeling the time wasn't ripe, right? Or right to do that. And, but in retrospect, I think about it, I don't regret the decision, but in 1982, I think right after Secret of NIMH came out, I think there was an animator strike.
Oh, wow.
And basically the studios were, you know, I think Don Bluth, who I was eventually going to work for.
Right.
Because I said, I'd like to go back to school. I just want to go to school for like another year or two. And then they said, okay, you know, that's fine, you know. And then so it was kind of like the offer was there, right?
Mm-hmm. On the table.
Kind of on the table. Yeah. Because they're willing to hire me then, you know. I can't see why they wouldn't hire me the year after, right?
Of course, yeah.
So the, but then there was an animator strike. And that screwed up everything. Because now studios were now sending things overseas to have it done.
Oh, wow.
And Don, who had another feature in the works, you know, it was, I think that was kind of curtailed because of that. Had another film, so all of a sudden that was.
Which film was that?
I think it was East of the Sun, West of the Moon.
Oh, okay.
I think that was the next film that they were going to do, but yeah, all of a sudden those prospects kind of went away real quick because now they were fighting because Secret of NIMH did not do all that well. You know, it made back its money. It probably made back all of its money on video. But MGM UA, it was a United Artists picture, and UA was acquired by MGM, so it became MGM UA. And normally what happens in those situations, a lot of times the new management just kind of kills their young. So anything that was in the pipeline
mm-hmm.
gets, you know.
The axe.
Yeah. And okay. I mean, part of the one of the films that came out of that was, what, Poltergeist. But that wasn't axed. I think they realized, oh yeah, we gotta do some. But Secret of NIMH wasn't properly publicized. They didn't put any money into it. I think Bluth ended up the company that was financing the movie threw some money into the publicity of it, and they had high hopes. But there was no, you know, publicity is so important to anything.
Yeah.
If you have a record album,
right,
you could have the greatest record album in the world. You could have the greatest film in the world. But mm-hmm. the thing is if nobody knows about it, you're sunk.
Dust.
And sometimes these things kind of come back, though, because the movie is so good. So in the case of Secret of NIMH,
mm-hmm.
it garnered, I guess there were a lot of people that bought it on video. And so it developed a good reputation after that. And so it, you know, but, you know, they didn't see any of that money. But A Christmas Story is another one that I think about, that the film came out, died in the theaters. It was like nobody really went to see it. And then it came on cable. And then all of a sudden it kind of exploded. People found it. And I was one of the people that found it. And I thought it was such a good film. It was a personal film, you know. And it just ended up becoming this thing now. And it's like, you know,
it's amazing how something can die in the theaters. And then several years later, people can't imagine a single Christmas season without watching that, you know.
Right. Yeah. And I think that came around the same time. I want to say like 1982 when that acquisition happened.
Mm-hmm.
There's a film that you like called, Heaven's Gate.
Oh, gosh.
That basically sunk. That's the film that sunk you away.
Probably.
And, but you showed me some of it. I never saw it. But that motion picture basically was the film that did in United Artists.
The behemoth.
Yeah. And they ended up being swallowed up by MGM. So it became MGM UA. But that was probably the film that just was the catalyst to. to do all these other films in, unfortunately.
Of course, so. I love it.
So
someone had to. Yeah. What can I say?
But anyway, yeah. So I.
So you had your first big job offer, and then you were like, "No, I want to be perfect. I want to be better. You wanted more under your belt."
Yeah,
and I get that. I get that.
And this is a problem. You
don't regret, sorry to interrupt you, but you don't regret the decision because obviously, you know, but are there times where you're like, what would my trajectory have been had I blah, 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 you know, had I done da, 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 da.
Yeah. I mean, my whole life would have been totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I would not be doing this podcast. Maybe I would not be doing a podcast.
Oh, I don't like that. I don't like that outcome.
But it's amazing the turns you make.
Yeah.
But yeah, I often think about that, where I'd be in the animation world. But, you know, you can't look back. I made the choices for a reason, right? You make choices for what you feel is right at the time. And so you do that. So, you know, I don't regret it, you know.
So after that, then, okay, good. I'm glad you don't regret it because you clearly went on to become a, you know, like we said in our intro,
right,
celebrated, you know, very skilled, Emmy winning. But what was your big break after that? Like your real life where you actually were like, you had the chops and were like, I'm going for it.
I floundered for 2 years.
Oh, after man.
I think maybe about a year and a half. So I was sending out portfolios. And like I said, that animation strike just did everybody in. I mean, people who were already working in it, they were struggling a little bit more to find work. And then people who were not in it was basically, you'd have to take, basically you'd be taking the job of somebody else.
Or intimidated to accept.
A job, yeah.
Yeah.
I ended up, I was doing a lot of odd jobs. I ended up working for a department store and stuff like that for like a year. I ended up working for a electronics distribution house. So I was a warehouse manager for them. And this was in East Rockaway.
Mm-hmm.
East Rockaway. They don't exist anymore. But I went to work for them and they like me, you know, they like me. So I did that for a little bit. And I think sometime around late 1984, I was like, what the heck am I doing?
You know,
I'm working in retail, you know? I had much bigger aspirations. And I knew I was on the road to something. It was one morning I was working for them. I got up in the morning and it was just like, I can't do this anymore.
Right.
And I went in and I quit my job. And so I was still living at home, but I was like, I made a decision that morning that I'm just all out, just going for it.
Yeah.
And so I got a job. It was a part-time job. I was editing because I had some experience in that. You know, because I went to film school.
Right, yeah.
I had film experience, yeah.
This period of time, sorry to interject, you're floundering, working in retail.
Right.
You know, everybody's now a little gun-shy on the heels of this strike business. Yeah. And were you privately, in your own time, still keeping up with your artwork and your those skills and...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, but not aggressive. Not aggressive enough. And, you know, maybe it took a month off from doing it, you know, or
just enough to keep it.
Just to keep it going. But I was
breathing.
But yeah, I think I was a little bit discouraged from the strike thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew what that meant. And I would talk to people, you know, I'd still call people and ask them and they'd be like, yeah, there's nothing. Nothing really going on. So there were little projects that were happening. But like I said, they had people that were already in the business that were doing those. And they weren't really taking new people at that time. So, you know, the breaks were very limited. I mean, I would pick up a job. There was a project going in, I think, New York Tech, which is up in Old Westbury, New York, and they were working on something that was, I think it was like a feature film. I don't know if it ever came out, but I ended up working for like a week on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the things that I was trying to pick up. There was somebody that had they're doing a little commercial in Long Beach, and they hired me for that.
Mm-hmm.
It was like for 3 days.
Right.
It's like all these little things.
Yeah.
But primarily I was working, doing a little bit of editing, and I got a job doing that. And that was even too much, mm-hmm. you know? So I was like, if I'm going to commit, I really got to really like even go back to school, go back to drawing classes and stuff like that. And
yeah.
So I went back to Art Students League in early 1985. And so when I went there, I had an instructor over there. He was a professional illustrator. And so the first drawing I did over there was, it was a nude model. But there was something different this time because this guy came around the room and he was looking at everybody's stuff and he stopped at what I was doing because I was working in chalk or pastel.
Right.
And on a big pad. And he came around and he stopped and he goes, "Oh, a professional."
Oh, wow.
And that's when I was like, oh, okay. So I'm definitely, the guy's calling me a professional. I remember my response to him. I said, not really, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And I said, I'm still trying to work my way.
Yeah.
But so it was kind of like, you know, it was part, you know, this is great. And then the other part was like, well, yeah, I'm not. You know,
it was kind of a double-edged sword.
But the thing was that I just felt like, okay, you know, I got to take it for what it is. And so I was going there, I was going to Art Students League and I was feeling very, I got to a point where I was getting discouraged again.
Okay.
And, I was like, you know, because I was also applying for jobs.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of getting them and not getting them or getting interest and not getting actually offered. So probably late 85, I was sitting on a bench and this older woman, she came up and she sat down on the bench next to me.
A bench where?
Inside Art Students League. They had, you know, benches throughout.
Okay.
You know, places where you could hang out between classes. And
got it.
So anyway, I was sitting on the bench, and this lady, very nice lady.
Because you said you're sitting on a bench, and all I envisioned was Forrest Gump with a box of chocolates.
I didn't have any chocolates.
Okay.
And I'm not Forrest Gump, that's for sure.
No.
So anyway, no, so she sits down next to me, and we're just chatting. And she says to me, all of a sudden she just comes out, and she said, you know, I have a gift. I can read people. Just out of the blue. and so I go, I'm not quite sure where she's going, although I kind of know where she's going with this. And she goes, I just need to touch an article of clothing. And then she's like, and she's not trying to be too invasive, you know. So she, you know, I could just touch your sneaker. I could touch your, I was wearing sneakers. So she touches my sneaker and she starts telling me. So basically she's reading me. She's doing a psychic reading on me. And so she tells me where I live, because this Art Students League is in Manhattan. She tells me, you don't live in the city. You live on Long Island. I've never met this woman before in my life. And so she's telling me where I'm living. She's telling me where I grew up.
Like the town.
She's not saying the town, but she told me what house, some type of house. She's saying, you know, you're living in a Cape Cod style house. It's red, which it was. And she starts going into all the stuff. And then she says, you know, you're going to be working in commercial art. She couldn't say to me it was going to be animation, but she said, you're going to be working in commercial art and you're not going to be working here in the city. She said, you're going to be living on the West Coast.
Uh-huh.
And so she kept talking. I mean, and all this stuff was just like, how can she possibly know? But I'm like really intrigued, you know?
Right.
And she said, you're going to be working, you're going to be doing artwork, you're going to ask for what you want, and you're going to get it.
Wow.
And which is true. It all turned out true. And she said, and all I see is like, you're going to have a desk by a window overlooking the countryside.
Wow.
And which I also had. And so, and then she said, okay, that's all I got.
Okay. So you were 22?
85, probably. Yeah, probably.
Okay. 22. And she was not a student at the school.
She might've been.
Okay.
But I never saw her again. This is a weird thing.
That's so odd. So yeah. This is going back to, and how old was this woman? Not that it matters, but.
I would say she was like late 50s or maybe in her 60s.
Okay.
She was much older.
Okay.
But she was very, very nice.
Yeah.
And I almost feel like, and people probably say, yeah, right. You know, but I think people come into your life for a reason. I think things happen I always feel this.
Well, I know you, and I know that you do not lie. and I do, and I also know that interesting people and interesting experiences seem to gravitate towards
hence
you.
Why I'm writing a book.
But, the book, yeah. Exactly, of but, the coincidences that are not coincidences.
Yeah. Now, I think that things happen in your life. That whole thing with Don Bluth was just a weird thing, weird, wonderful thing that happened. Because I did eventually work for them. But I think things, you know, when you are really interested in something, I think things just kind of gravitate toward you. I think with this instance, with this lady sitting next to me, I think it was something that I needed at that point. Because when she gave me that reading, it was kind of like a
nudge.
More than a nudge, it was like a punch in the arm.
Oh, okay.
Because, no, well, because it gave me enough. I mean, between what was said to me by this instructor,
the professional,
mm-hmm. and then having this lady, this wonderful woman, who, like I said, never saw her again.
Wow.
Was at a time when I needed it, and then basically pushed me on to actually start getting some good responses.
Okay, so not a nudge, a catapult.
Pretty much.
Okay,
yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, so I attribute that. And, you know, if she's still around, you know, thank you so much for doing that for me, you know.
Do you have any questions or comments about the podcast? Please email Brian at cartoonerific.com. Your email may be featured in one of our future shows.
Well, thank you, Mr. Brian Mitchell, for coming on the show and doing that interview. And Brian will be back next week, and it will be actually Marjorie Stewart will be doing that interview. She'll be helming that show, that interview, with yours truly next week. So please come back to hear that. Well, I have to say that this was an interesting turn of events here, being on the other side of the interview table and I kind of enjoyed it. It was a little bit more relaxed for me to do this interview. And thank you, Marjorie Stewart, so much for being such a wonderful, wonderful interviewer. So, you know, thank you. Anyway, if you really like what you're listening to, and here comes the old spiel, please subscribe. All you have to do is go to your favorite service that you get the Cartoonerific podcast from and hit the subscribe button. So every time a brand new episode is uploaded, you'll get to hear it like right then and there. So that's wonderful. Anyway, if you really like what you're listening to, please tell a friend. Very, very important. Send them a link to the podcast or tell them how much you like it. You know, share it. Let them know about it. It helps us. It's going to help you too, because we'll bring more podcasts and stuff like that. So it's a win-win for everybody. Anyway, I want everybody to have a great day. I want you to have an excellent week. Thanksgiving is coming up. I want you to have a great Thanksgiving holiday. Take care, everybody.
This has been a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
The Cartoonerific podcast is copyright 2024 by Cartoonerific Studios Incorporated. All rights reserved.